Welcome to the Red Letter Christians podcast. Red Letter Christians gets our name from the Bibles that highlight the words of Jesus in red. And we're aspiring to live as if Jesus meant the stuff he said. We know that the loudest, most prominent voices representing Christianity in America haven't always been the most beautiful or the most faithful voices. And we know that the way we change the narrative is by changing the narrators. We are committed to amplifying the voices of people who are dedicated to Jesus and to justice. How much longer will
justice be? Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening in. This is Shane Claiborne, and I'm so excited that you are tuning in to the radio show or podcast. If you're new to this, you might want to know that I am a Christian talking about how our faith connects to the world that we live in. And for too long, many Christians have used faith as just a ticket into heaven and an excuse to ignore the world that we live in. But, you know, when I read the Bible, almost every time Jesus opens his mouth, he talks about the kingdom of God, and not just as something we go to when we die, but something we're to bring on earth as it is in heaven. So if you're, you know, not really a person of faith, if you care about the world, if you're curious about faith, you've had a bad experience, whatever, you're welcome. This is for everybody. And I get to hang out with people that I love and admire, whose work inspires me. And this is going to be a really great conversation today. I'll introduce our guest in a second, but I want to say that many of us are concerned about this phenomena that we're gonna dissect a little bit, but it's often called Christian nationalism. We've talked about it a lot on this show, but it's essentially a version of nationalism that's trying to camouflage itself as Christianity. And I think, and many others think as well, that it is a threat to our democracy in the United States, but it's also a threat to authentic Christianity, because it doesn't look much like Jesus. It doesn't sound much like Jesus. And so in segue to my guest today, let me say, I'm so excited to talk about this with Catherine Stewart, who is an amazing person and also an amazing writer, gotten all kinds of awards and bestseller lists and all that. She's written the Good News Club, but also this new book that I'm really excited about. I guess it's kind of new. It's been around a while, but it's still inspiring a lot of folks and helping us understand things that are can be a little confusing. But it's called The Power Worshippers. Catherine's book, The Power Worshippers, the subtitle is Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. So she's an investigative reporter, been on everything, New York Times, NBC, New Republic, The New Yorker, and is a friend. We've got to hang out a few times, so it's good to talk. Thanks for carving out time, Catherine.
Shane, it's so great to be in conversation with you today. Thank you. And I think you really got the problem of religious nationalism or Christian nationalism in America just right. It's the exploitation of religion for politics and power. People sometimes say, you know, is this what Christian? Of course, this is not what Christianity is. Most American Christians reject the politics of conquest and division that this movement represents. It's almost like the religion is distorted in order to conform to the politics rather than the other way around.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this really prominent scene in the Gospels in the beginning of Jesus's ministry where he gets tempted by the devil, right? And faces these three temptations that, you know, I will give you all the power of this world. And then the devil says, you know, I fling yourself from the, you know, the temple and turn stones into bread. And I was telling somebody the other day, like, if you believe that Jesus made the wrong decision in the temptation in the desert, then you might be a Christian nationalist, because like it feels like this thirst for power and this thirst that to clutch the worldly power and to believe that, you know, this is how God's reign's going to come. It's going to come through America. But, you know, this is kind of your central thing. The title of the book, The Power Worshippers, is that it's almost like we never really understood Jesus when he said, what good is it to gain the whole world and forfeit your soul? And it feels like that's what's happened to a lot of evangelical Christianity. It's trying to gain the whole world and it's lost its soul.
Well, it's interesting. I think there have long been strains of this kind of, I would say, religious nationalism in America. If you look at, say, the pro-slavery theologians like Robert Louis Stabney or James Henley Thornwell, who used religion to justify the idea of hierarchies ordained by God, black people over white, white people over black people, right? This is, they use religion to justify that. If you think about people like Gerald K. Smith in the late 1920s to the 40s, who started the Christian Nationalist Party, you know, ran for president, is a failed candidate, of course, and started a sort of a religious nationalist political party. I mean, we can see strains of this through our history. But what we're seeing today is something different in the contemporary context. We've seen a movement, frankly, that has taken over one of our two major political parties. I think for a long time, the Republican Party understood that there was a sort of Christian right or, you know, very sort of fundamentalist movement, and they felt like they could make use of this movement. They were reliable voters, and leaders of that movement represented themselves as just wanting a seat at the table in the noisy forum of American democracy. What's happened is, unfortunately, as that movement has gathered strength over 5 or 6 decades of infrastructure building, the gatekeeping institutions, the Republican Party, have fallen apart, and the movement has become sort of hotter and more extreme as it's, you know, as it's progressed into the future. So now it's many of the extremists that are actually calling the shot.
And we've both interacted and gotten to know Kristen Dumais a little bit, and she's been on this show, and her wonderful book, Jesus and John Wayne. She, one of the things that she points out is that it's not that, that some evangelical Christians think that Donald Trump is actually the Messiah, but they wish that the Messiah, that Jesus, looked a little bit more like Donald Trump. That idea of like turning the other cheek. I mean, even Donald Trump kind of laughs at that, you know, like, and scoffs at the idea of loving your enemies, or much less, you know, I think like selling what you have and give it to the poor. Like pretty much everything in the Sermon on the Mount, like Trump and that whole scene is really a direct contradiction of the Beatitudes and those things. You know, I was saying it's very problematic to me that this person that many Christians seem to like is literally embodying the seven deadly sins. I mean, I believe God can change any heart, but when you read through those, you know, like, he's doing pretty good at those, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a leadership-driven movement. It's really not driven by the rank and file. And for the leaders of the movement, Donald Trump gave them everything they wanted. He gave them unprecedented political power and political access. He gave them policies that they want. He gave them judges that they want, because the movement knows that if you can, you know, the best way to force unpopular policies onto the rest of the country is through through the law and through the courts. The movement, Donald Trump gave them access to public money. You know, a lot of the policies he promoted would increase access to public money. A lot of the justices that he put on the Supreme Court are in making decisions that will increase the flow of public money to conservative religious institutions. But there is something more than that. As Kristen so wisely points out, we should always listen to what she says. She's a wonderful, very astute observer of the political scene. He represents the lawlessness, a kind of authoritarian, I would say the authoritarian impulses of his supporters. This is a movement that simply doesn't believe in democracy. It holds the principles of pluralism and equality and justice that undergird our democracy with contempt. And he has no respect for those principles either, principles of equality or pluralism or justice. So in this way, when he behaves like an authoritarian who wants to sort of crack the heads of his political enemies, he's acting out and articulating the resentments that they themselves feel.
Yeah, and this is obviously bigger than Donald Trump, and it existed before Donald Trump and will exist after Trump. So I think your work is so good in the power worshipers at helping us understand kind of how we got here. And I know you could probably do a 6-hour course on all of this, but give us a little crash backdrop of, especially for folks that might be listening overseas or something. And I mean, there's things happening in other countries that are also very concerning. And it feels like, as scripture talked about the principalities and powers, that some of those same principalities and powers are at work in other countries. But, you know, lay out just a little bit. I mean, everybody hopefully will grab your book to dive in full on, but of how we got here. And is Trump the symptom or the disease? You know, we were saying Trump didn't change America. He revealed America. But it does feel like if he comes to power again, there's some things that could permanently change our country, I think, with another kind of Trump administration.
That's true. You know, there's so much to talk about here. But you know, when we're talking about what could happen here, I don't think we need to imagine exotic threat, because the world already offers plenty of examples of what could happen here. We think about a leader like Vladimir Putin in Russia. It's, you know, theocratic in a certain fake sense. That is, his is the regime that endorses a particular religion and attempts to impose a conservative version of that religion, that, and it's sort of, I would say, patriarchal values and its homophobic values on society. But it's more accurately described as a cronyist kleptocracy with very strong militaristic features and absolute suppression of political opposition and free speech. So I think, again, it shows how the religion piece of it, the exploitation of religion, is sort of an excuse for doing all this other bad stuff. We can also look at a country like Erdogan's Turkey, right? Who he's arrested and jailed thousands of academics and journalists and political opponents. We can look at a place like Hungary under Viktor Orban, who has basically criminalized some of the fundamental democratic activities in that country. And he's attacked the independence of the courts. He's implemented strict controls over media. And yet, who much of the American right explicitly celebrates. I think he just gave a talk at Mar-a-Lago. Trump sort of praised him as a leader who's, you know, the buck stops with him. I'm sort of paraphrasing here, but he said he's a great leader because he's strong and what he says goes. I mean, that's dictatorship in a way, isn't it? So Trump himself has actually promised to be a dictator on at least day one. And if anybody thinks that sort of dictatorial style of management is going to end after day one, you know, I think they would be mistaken. So there's a lot that's at stake here. And, you know, back to, you know, the question, like, how did we get here? Well, I think it's really important to understand that in the contemporary context, this is a movement that's leadership driven and it's organization driven. So back in the, I would say, late 1970s, early 1980s, a movement calling itself the New Right arose. They involved people like Paul Weyrich and Phyllis Schlafly and Howard Phillips and so many others. They felt the Republican Party had gone too far to the left, too soft on communism. They were very upset also about a more social gospel form of Christianity. They were very disapproving of Tillich, for instance, and Niebuhr and other sort of more liberal theologians. And they basically wanted to drag religion and politics off to the right. So there's various things that they did. One of the key things that they did is they created all of these organizations, and they invested over time a lot of money in those organizations. A lot of extremely wealthy people also invested their fortunes in these organizations. And I think some of those folks were driven more by sort of far-right economic policy, sort of libertarian economic policy, than by right-wing positions in the so-called culture wars. And, you know, we can get into that more if you'd like, you know, put a pin in that, because that discussion is way too long to get into right this very second. But what we're seeing is that the strength of the movement now rests in that very dense organizational infrastructure that serves as a get-out-the-vote machine during election cycles. So they focus, when they're messaging to the rank and file, they focus on these culture war issues like abortion or, you know, same-sex marriage or some of the, you know, public school issues that are coming up now. And they know if you can get people to vote on a single issue, you can control their vote. So a lot of times people vote on those issues because they think, you know, it's an identity thing. They think, well, I stand for family values, so I'm going to vote for the party that allegedly stands for family values. And meanwhile, they're driving support for politicians whose economic policies are basically making it so much harder for American families to succeed.
Yeah. And so if you're just tuning in, y'all, this is a wonderful privilege to talk with Catherine Stewart. One of her many writings is The Power Worshippers. That's kind of what we're talking about today. The phenomena of Christian nationalism, religious nationalism, and especially what the dangerous things that we see happening in our country and all the lights on the radar that should be alarming us. I think this is interesting because when I look at, we won't go too far into the history, although everybody should read your book, but I'm interested in like the new generation, right? It seems like there's an aging out of some of this. Tony Campolo and I wrote an article in the New York Times, the religion of old white men is dead a while ago, but then Trump got elected right after that, I think. We're like, maybe it's not as dead as we thought it was. But, you know, there is, you think of Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, I mean, these folks that were the old religious right. And are there new charismatic leaders? I mean, I think of like Charlie Kirk and some of these voices that are out there. Like what is the new leadership and the new funding of that old movement look like right now?
Oh, gosh. I mean, those are two amazing questions. There is no shortage of funding coming from, I mean, there are too many funders to mention, but let's just look at Barry Side, an octogenarian billionaire from Chicago, who is Jewish, actually. He's not Christian. He donated $1.6 billion to form the Marble Freedom Trust. And guess who he put in trust in charge of it? Leonard Leo, who was formerly, you know, head of the Federalist Society, and also the sort of adjacent organizations through which hundreds of millions of dollars were funneled in order to reshape the courts according to a conservative Christian nationalist agenda. They can spend over $200 million, I think $230 million per year on right-wing politics without touching the nut. I mean, it's just an extraordinary donation. I think it might be the largest political donation in history, but there are plenty of other funders. I think about the Bradley Foundation, the Sarah Sky Foundation. There's a tremendous amount of funding that comes from the conservative Catholic sphere, like Thomas Monahan, founder of Domino's Pizza, or Sean Feiler, or so many others. So the movement really has no shortage of deep-pocketed funders. A lot of them, for instance, the Wilkes brothers or Tim Dunn in Texas, they hail from these extractive industries where they really don't want any environmental regulations on what they do. They don't want any, they want to sort of reduce the regulatory landscape. I think there's of course the DeVos Prince family juggernaut. If you want to have fun one day, just, you know, for a lark, Google Betsy DeVos's yachts, like plural yachts, and then her houses. I mean, it's just, I think a lot of people in America don't know how rich, like there's the very rich and then there's the truly rich. Do you know what I mean? Like these people have like fortunes like you wouldn't believe. I mean, a lot of people talk about the Koch brothers, but they're just one of the many, many other folks in this space. And the Kochs, interestingly, I mean, if you go through their Form 990s, they actually give a lot of money to other initiatives, not just sort of religious right or even right-wing initiatives. They have a very broad range of groups that they fund. But on the movement side, the funneling money to organizations like the Heritage Foundation or the Alliance Defending Freedom or Liberty Council or Family Research Council or so many other pieces of the infrastructure, the Council for National Policy, which is a key networking organization that brings together funders and movement leaders. There's just no shortage of funding. So that's just the money piece of it. And then when you're talking about the youth, I mean, this movement is actually really good at cultivating talent. I mean, on the left, I think people often invest in technocratic solutions and policy, and sometimes people invest in organizations that are working in silo, right?
Yeah.
Or issues that are operating in these sort of siloized spheres. On the right, they invest in organizations and people. So a lot of the people within the movement get the sense that they can secure their economic futures within the movement. And there's a lot of investment in, you know, finding and cultivating younger leaders. So if you go to any, I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that it's one thing to buy a really good sound system, but you still have to have a really good spokesperson or someone that is worth listening to. And, you know, I think someone like Franklin Graham, I have been deeply, deeply troubled by many of the things that he's said. And yet my family's down in North Carolina. Many of them go to the same church as Franklin Graham. And there's a real respect because of the work they do overseas and stuff. There's some kind of credibility that I get why people listen to Franklin Graham, even though he says some really troubling things. But other folks, that just their only thing is to be a talking head on a screen. It's hard for me to understand how their credibility or what they say holds weight with a person in a pew when that person is also supposed to be having a moral compass of Jesus that feels so at odds with the kind of talking points. You know what I mean?
I do. I mean, a lot of people question whether movement leaders believe what they're actually saying. And I think we can't know what's in people's hearts. I think, you know, for some people, two things can be true. Once they can really believe what they're saying and then also have it be something that they've recognized is good for their careers. You know, but I think the more important point is that if you're looking, say, even at Trump, you know, does he believe his own lies? You know, a majority of Republican voters actually believe him when he speaks. There was last summer a survey, a sort of YouGov survey, and his supporters astonishingly trust him even more than they trust their family and friends, conservative media, or even their own religious leaders. So we can't really overstate the role of conspiracism and disinformation, not only in promoting him, but also the role of conspiracism and disinformation that's all too often promoted through a lot of conservative-leaning churches. You know, there's an organizations out there like Watchmen on the Wall and Faith Wins and Church United. They bring movement leaders together. They do presentations at churches, drawing in, you know, dozens or even hundreds of local pastors. And then they give them these talking points and voter guides, etc. And I've been to a number of these gatherings. I went to one that I describe in Southern California, where they're promoting lies about what's being taught in public school. Mm-hmm. You know, I had to go back and fact check. And, you know, a lot of the pastors there really were astonished by all of this stuff and, you know, really moved by it. But it, you know, the majority of what they were saying simply wasn't true. And none of what they were saying was being applied in the schools in the manner that they implied.
I definitely know one thing I can remember Trump saying that was true, which is I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people would still support me. But, you know, before we run out of time on the radio show, I want to invite you to talk about this new film, because it was really inspired by your book. And the film, if you haven't seen it, y'all, is called God and Country, and it was produced by Rob and Michelle Reiner. So do you want to say a little bit about the film and what you thought they got right, anything they might have not quite had time to get into or anything?
You know, it's interesting. Films, books can speak to a general audience. You can put so much into a book. First, I just want to say, I'm so honored to have written the book that the project was based upon and that follows the political analysis I lay out in Power Shippers very closely. And I'm also just so thankful to the director for finding the story that he really wanted to tell and bringing in such wonderful voices to articulate different pieces of it. So I think that, you know, the film is definitely aimed at not only showing how religious nationalism is a political movement and it represents a threat to our democracy, but also showing Christians from a broad range of perspectives who say, this really does not represent my faith either. It's an exploitation of my faith, and I'm not okay with that. So I think those two messages come through loud and clear, and I'm, you know, grateful for that team for emphasizing those issues.
Yeah, it was wonderful. I've just seen pieces of it, but there's so many friends in it. I'm like, oh, yeah, amen. You know, so it's great.
There's so many people that could have been included. And, you know, I certainly wasn't in charge of those decisions, but, you know.
So good. Yeah. And so yeah. If you haven't seen it, y'all, that the movie we're talking about, the film is God and Country. And the voice you've been listening to is Catherine Stewart, who has written many wonderful things, but this book we're talking about, The Power Worshippers, which was the inspiration for the new film. We'll have to keep talking and make sure y'all check out Catherine's work. How can people find you? You got your website, but any other ways that folks can follow you on socials and whatnot?
That's right. CatherineStewart.me, and my Twitter, I'm still calling it Twitter, is Kath S. Stewart. That there's two S's there. Kath S. Stewart.
Awesome. Well, thanks for listening, y'all, and we will be with you next week.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. I want to keep talking just a little bit. If you got like five more minutes, is that okay?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So for folks listening on the podcast, one of the things I was going to ask you is like, what do you think like healthy democracy, your kind of dream for American democracy, if Christians didn't get in the way and, you know, others, like what might that look like as you imagine what you hope for a generation from now?
I mean, I think that, you know, our founders got a lot of stuff right. The idea, if you look at the Let me think this through. Are you gonna record
we
this?
Can
so
yeah
let
we
me
can edit this
yeah
yeah
let me
yeah
think this through. I think that our founders got a lot of this right, the idea that our public policy should be debated in public and grounded in the principles of, you know, equality and rational debate and reason, the idea of justice that applies equally to all, the idea that you know, no one has more rights than the other, the idea that the law applies to us all, and the idea that we should sort of treat one another with, you know, empathy and concern for the common good. I mean, these are all really great ideas that I think are baked into some of our founding documents. And I think, you know, all these principles have never been applied perfectly, and that's okay. Yeah. We're none of us perfect, but they're ideas we should aspire to in our society.
Yeah, I've always thought that saying, you know, on the front of our U.S. Supreme Court that says equal justice under the law is a great aspiration. We've got ways to go, as our brother Brian Stevenson often says, that our criminal justice system treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you are poor and innocent.
Absolutely. And race is a big part of that as well.
Yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, you know, race has always been a big issue in our country as well. It remains so. This is one of the reasons why the right really doesn't want American school children to learn that side of our history. They don't want us to learn about the reality of structural racism and its consequences. And, you know, they're engaged in race-based gerrymandering and voter suppression because they're threatened by the idea of equality and justice for all. Some
yeah,
of them are
I think
even
it's
talking
worth unpacking that just a little bit more too, because some of the conversations you and I have been in with other friends is, you know, including white in this language of Christian nationalism, white Christian nationalism, and even as you look at the religious right, I went into a little bit of debt, nodding at wonderful historians like you and this new book I did, Rethinking Life, but talking about how abortion was not a central issue, but became a central issue partly because it's hard to build a movement around segregation and racism, which is exactly what was happening to many of the Christian colleges that wanted the right to continue to segregate and to, for instance, not prohibit interracial dating, and in some cases, not even to prohibit Black students on campus. And so it was, you know, this backdrop was not really Roe versus Wade, but Brown versus Board and the racial justice movement, the civil rights movement, and trying to find its way through that. So, you know, I build on Randall Balmer's work and others as we kind of look at that history. But it's impossible to ignore that residue is still there. I mean, when we think of the Black Lives Matter movement, the first Black president, the changing demographics of America, a lot of this rise in nationalism is a response to white fragility and nostalgia and how the country used to be, make America great again. It's not that coded for make America white again, right? Like we're thinking about what does it look like for white folks who have been the power holders to begin to lose some of that power and the kind of what I think Van Jones and others have called not just like backlash, but white lash, you know, to some of that mm-hmm. is what we see. So do you want to say anything more about the role that race plays in the worship of power?
Well, it's interesting that we have the normalization right now of conspiracies like the Great Replacement Theory, which is this idea that, you know what Reawaken America is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I've
yeah.
been to a bunch mm-hmm. of, have you been to one of these Reawaken America tours? There, you should just go as like a field trip. I've been to three of them that you walk in there, every single conspiracy is being thrown about, you know, ivermectin, you know, the COVID, they're microchipping us, you know, one world government. There's a lot of Great Replacement stuff that they're talking about. Of course, the conspiracy of the big lie that this like 2020 election was stolen is the overarching conspiracy. But they're talking a lot more openly about the Great Replacement, this idea that the Democratic Party is deliberately replacing, quote unquote, real Americans, which is code for white Americans, white Christian Americans, with others who are, you know, people of color. They promote this idea that they're open borders, which there aren't. But it's a sort of cultivation of fear and a cultivation of racial resentment. resentment. And I think some of the epithets that are thrown around these days by the right, like CRT and what they call woke, whatever that means, it's a way to sort of say something that it's almost like a dog whistle for racism without actually having to say it. When they criticize, you know, woke corporations and DEI, what they're really upset about is the idea that, you know, some Black woman at a community college in the Midwest might be given a promotion. Like, I mean, do you know what I mean? And then they take this idea that somehow, you know, undeserving others, as they see it, are getting sort of, you know, replacing us, and the us is people who they say or they believe deserve to have that the privileges in America, you know, white, conservative, not all Christians, not you, Shane, sorry, but people who believe correctly, people with the right political ideology, people with the right gender and ethnicity, of course. So, and then, you know, when folks talk about the promise of whiteness, it's basically dangling this carrot in front of people of color in a way, saying, well, if you believe correctly, you can have the privileges that we will confer upon you, the privileges of what, you know, is sort of whiteness, although they don't use that language, but it's a code for a kind of privilege. But at the end of the day, this is, you know, I think race and racism remains a really vital factor in this movement. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not appealing to people of color. I mean, if you look at, say, between 2016 and 2020, Latino voters overall shifted 8 to 10 points in favor of Donald Trump, precisely because of this sort of a lot of the religious nationalist rhetoric and a lot of the culture war stuff going, you know, directed toward Latino, conservative Latino churches, often, you know, charismatic or Pentecostal churches. But so the race part of it is complex. But when you hear stuff about the great replacement, that kind of language being normalized, that's absolutely racist dog whistling.
Well, you've been so generous with your time. I have one more question. And then if there's anything else that you didn't get to say that you want to say, we are all ears. I wanted, you know, I think of that line where Dr. Martin Luther King said, those of us who love peace have got to be as organized as those who love war. And I think for those of us who love democracy and those who, for me as a Christian, who love Jesus, have got to live out our faith in a public way that counters the narrative of Christian nationalism. So I wanted you to say a little bit of what the resistance looks like. Where do we see that growing? How can people, how do you see people effectively confronting Christian nationalism?
Yeah, I think, look, there's things we can do as individuals, like vote and get our friends out, friends and family out, speak to our communities, whether it's a faith community or any other type of community, helping them understand why democracy matters and what's at stake and getting them out to vote. And then there are things we can only do when we join together with others. I mean, there are no shortage of avenues for engagement. Everybody needs to pick their lane. There are so many organizations working on democracy building and preservation of our rights. And, you know, we need to try to work in less siloed ways and reach out to those of us, others who we have things in common with. You know, I do a lot of my research by going to right-wing conferences and strategy gatherings. And they talk about how there's, you know, they've been paraphrasing Ronald Reagan, who said, the person who agrees with you 80% of the time is your 80% friend, not your 20% enemy. And I think we need to operate that way as well. We need a really big tent. We find people who can agree on the fundamentals that, you know, democracy matters. We should have equal rights. Voting matters. Equality and justice matter. Then we should forgive one another for some differences that we may have and join together and work together. We're just really going to need a big tent. But we should take courage from the fact that there are more Americans who agree with the framework of democracy than disagree. We have the majority. We really need to just act like it.
How about that? Well, you heard it here, y'all. Catherine Stewart, floating Ronald Reagan and whatnot. any closing thoughts as you've done so much great work on this. I know we told people how to follow your work, but anything I didn't ask you that you want to talk about or things on the horizon that folks should know about?
Oh, it's just great to talk with you, Shane. I mean, I do have another book coming out, but I'm not ready to talk.
Not ready to talk about it yet.
When I'm ready, I'll come back on maybe and we can talk about that. It'd be a lot of fun.
Totally. And you know, we got a little book club at Red Letter Christians. We maybe that would be a good fit. But thanks for all your wonderful work and the spirit in which you do it. I hope I get to see you soon. But thanks for giving us some of your time today.
Great to chat.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Red Letter Christians podcast. Too often, Christians have used our faith as a ticket into heaven and a license to ignore the world we live in. But at Red Letter Christians, we believe our faith is not just about going to heaven when we die, but also about bringing heaven to earth while we live. For more information on Red Letter Christians and upcoming events, additional resources, you can go to the show notes or our website, redletterchristians.org. You can also support Red Letter Christians by giving a one-time donation or becoming a monthly sustainer. Just go to our website and click the red donate button. Thank you for being a part of this conversation and for being a part of this movement.